Welcome, everyone, to The Independent, the Indie Weeks, our weekly broadcast on the ncreadingservice.org. I'm John Federson with this week's issue, which is copyrighted or datelined March the 20th of 2025. And as we may know, some of us may know, it's the March solstice. The sun's right over the equator today and tomorrow. And the day and night are about the same length. But my program length is an hour and a half, and that's all I have. Excuse me, it's 58 minutes. So I'm going to get started with reading you some stories right now. The first broadcast of this, in effect, a podcast, is going to be Friday, March the 21st. But I have a long collection of stories to read to you, and I better get started. This begins in the North Carolina State Police and some arrests and deaths made. All right. Henrietta Mason told reporters on Friday that after her son, 31-year-old Tyrone, died in a crash on Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh in October, the police officers who knocked on her door told her it was a single-car accident with no witnesses. Tyrone, a father of four, was, quote, terrified of sirens, and police officers, his mother said, and that's how she knew his death was not the accident it was made out to be. She said at a press conference, I knew someone was chasing my son. And that she was at the press conference, was outside the Archdale building, which houses the State Highway Patrol. Quote, and when they told me that it was the state trooper that drove up and found my son, I said, he did it. Day one. Raleigh police told news outlets that Mason was traveling north on Capitol Boulevard in the early morning of October 7th when his Chevrolet Malibu crashed into a concrete barrier. Police said Mason was speeding, lost control of the car near the Wake Forest Road overpass, crossed the median into the southbound lanes, collided with the barrier by bridge supports. Since the crash, the Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman announced she was dropping more than 180 pending cases involving Garrett Macario, the state trooper who responded to the crash that killed Mason, and his supervisor, Sergeant Matthew Morrison. Freeman is reviewing a dozen more cases involving this pair. Investigators contacted Freeman in December about an investigation they were conducting into the crash, according to reports, and Freeman dropped the cases after reviewing the dashboard and body camera footage from Mason's crash, leading to speculation that the crash happened as a result of a chase. Now, the Mason family attorney, Sean Cecil, and the nationally known civil rights lawyers, Ben Crump and Bakari Sellers, are urging state officials, including Governor Josh Stein and Attorney General Jeff Jackson, to publicly release the video footage. Sellers said at a press conference, they can simply say today that we're going to release these videos. They can make sure these officers are held to account. They can make sure these officers are arrested. They can make sure these officers are fired. They can actually do examinations throughout the department of their policies and procedures under state law. The law enforcement agency that is the custodian of the video footage would need to petition the court for its release. A spokesperson from Stein's office said Friday it does not have custody of the footage nor the authority to release it. A Justice Department spokesperson said the Attorney General's office does not have the authority to release the footage and is not currently involved in the investigation. Mason confirmed to reporters that she has viewed the camera footage, but it took 3 weeks for her to get access to the video. Mason's attorney said she knocked on a lot of doors, went to all the agencies, sent hundreds of emails in an effort to find out what happened to Tyrone. Cecil said a month passed before Mason called him, and we started digging, and answers started happening. A video does exist. A compelling video exists. And Sellers said Mason's case points to a broader cultural issue with the state's highway patrol. Sellers said, I'm aware of other cases, just in research preparing for this, where video does exist, actually involving chases where aid was not rendered. In certain cases here in North Carolina, we know about those cases, so the question has to be asked from top to bottom about what their policies and procedures are about chases and what they're supposed to do on the scenes. And Sellers said the Mason family legal team plans to file a lawsuit in the coming days. All right, here is another story basically based in Raleigh. Go Triangle. Their strategic plan for 2025 to 2028 paints a picture of disorder and soul-searching at the regional transit agency. Some of the issues have been compounding for years after Go Triangle repeatedly failed to deliver on promises of large-scale rail project for the Triangle. The strategic plan acknowledges that its reputation suffered. Quote, public trust is holding Go Triangle back. There are other challenges, and there are more immediate. Go Triangle accepted CEO Charles Latuca's resignation in September and has yet to hire a permanent replacement. Preliminary ridership data for 2025 shows that overall boardings and on-time arrivals for the Go Triangle buses are both down compared to last year. Meanwhile, in a recent survey, Go Triangle's regional partners, which include other transit agencies, local governments, and area universities, identified a laundry list of perceived weaknesses at the agency, including rising costs, too many competing responsibilities, board structure and culture, a lack of demonstrated project delivery wins, a lack of responsiveness, and a culture of not owning past setbacks. To remedy that, the strategic plan explains the agency intends to make service improvements, implement fresh marketing strategy to attract new and lapsed riders, train its board in ethics and financial responsibility, and follow through on its marquee projects, the RUS bus facility in downtown Raleigh and the Triangle Mobility Hub in RTP, over the next 3 years. First things first, Go Triangle needs to hire a permanent CEO. Their general counsel, Byron Smith, took over from Latuca as acting CEO last year. Board chair and former mayor Mary Ann Baldwin wrote, "We need someone with strong leadership and communication skills who understands the value of partnerships externally. But we also need someone who will bring the Go Triangle team together internally, eliminating silos and improving communication throughout the organization." Asked how Go Triangle plans to address specific weaknesses like mistrust, funding, and board structure, Chief Communications Officer Eric Curry said the agency is, quote, upgrading its financial systems and adding interim positions that directly focus on transforming the agency's financial and organizational structure. The plan doesn't go into detail on when or how Go Triangle will achieve these goals. Mostly, it describes the agency's bird's-eye view of itself over the next 3 years: reliable, community-minded, and respected. The plan notes, a strategic plan does not provide a detailed daily operation plan, nor does it typically include an exhausting list of projects and activities that the organization undertakes over the life of the plan. Well, Go Triangle plans to publish its finalized strategic plan this July, according to Curry. The draft version is available as online as part of the board's February meeting minutes. Go Triangle's last strategic plan expired in 2021. Asked why there was no plan in place from 22 to 24, Baldwin suggested that the agency is still trying to reset its priorities after fumbles and false starts on light rail and commuter rail projects. She wrote in a statement, after focusing on commuter rail, then understanding we didn't score well due to a lack of density and a lack of federal funding, we had to process our new reality and pivot. These days, Go Triangle has abandoned its rail ambitions and set its sights on more manageable goals, according to Baldwin. She wrote, due to changes in commuting patterns and federal funding, Go Triangle is pivoting to other transportation options such as bus rapid transit. Go Triangle has not announced any bus rapid transit plans to date. The agency is not responsible for the Wake Bus Rapid Transit BRT project. Although they share similar names and branding, Go Triangle is a separate entity from Go Raleigh, Go Durham, and the Triangle's other local transit agencies. Concerns about rollbacks of federal funding for transportation add an extra layer of uncertainty for future planning, and Baldwin said, Go Triangle, along with transit agencies nationwide, could anticipate funding cuts as a result of policy change at the federal level. While federal funding plays a major role in the projects this agency will develop, so will our partnerships and ability to work with one another for the good of our region, which is the second fastest growing region in the country. Next, from Durham, it's kind of a positive article. Farmer Food Share is bringing more local produce to Durham Public Schools. This is a 14-year-old nonprofit food hub. It's ramping up its partnership with public schools to bring more locally sourced produce from farm to cafeteria table. DPS has worked with this food share dating back to 2016, but in recent years, the school district has reimagined its cafeteria menus to feature more nutritious meals, which required procuring a greater volume of local sourced products. At the start of the 24-5 school year, DPS signed a new 5-year procurement agreement with Farmer Food Share to provide schools with access to an assortment of fresh goods, mostly fruits and vegetables like apples, collard greens, sweet potatoes, sourced from farms across the state. The school system is still working with a larger distributor to meet the majority of its food needs, including meat. Food Share works directly with 70 North Carolina farmers, plus other vendors, making up a network of hundreds of producers. The Food Share prioritizes sourcing from historically marginalized farmers, farmers of color, women, and new farmers. They also support filling in the gaps for larger farm operations. Kelly Crane, executive director at Farmer Food Share, says the magic of North Carolina's climate makes it possible to have what she calls a four-season local food diet, so they can source food year-round. Sourcing locally does not come at a tremendous expense. Contrary to prevailing opinions about buying local, the route from farm to table has less intermediates, says Crane, which allows Farmer Food Share to weed out unnecessary costs in the supply chain, especially when they're working at scale to provide products for larger institutions like Duke University, UNC Chapel Hill, and DPS. The farmers benefit from the cost savings, too. Farmers working with Food Share make 70 cents on the dollar on average, compared to 14 cents return from traditional mainline distributors. As an added benefit, Farmer Food Share also takes on much of the administrative responsibilities like contracts and invoicing, instead of the farmers developing an individual relationship with each school or business and all the paperwork that comes with it. The Food Share is able to aggregate those relationships into larger bulk orders and pay farmers up front, which Cranes says allows the farmers to stick to what they do best, growing delicious produce. She says that we make it possible for farmers to enter the bigger leagues with very low risk on their part. But for DPS, keeping costs in check, even for a worthy cause like healthier school lunches, is important for a school district already facing tough questions about its budget. With federal funding more uncertain by the day, the school district will have to lean into its other partnerships in the community to give the school nutrition services program the resources it needs to be successful. School board chair Millicent Rogers said this: not being able to have the financial resources to do these things in the future is alarming, but we're Durham. We have to make a request of the chamber and local businesses to continue to invest in our students in this way because it's better for the overall benefit of the community. The partnership with Farmer Food Share builds on previous efforts to ensure students are well-fed in Durham and statewide. In 2022, DPS hired Dr. Lyndon Thayer to lead its new vision for school nutrition services. Thayer served as the Assistant Director of Food Systems Planning from 2022 until early this year and was instrumental in cultivating the healthy food operation. Then, in October 2023, former Governor Roy Cooper announced at Glen Elementary School in Durham $1.5 million in grant funding to support expanding opportunities for school breakfast programs in North Carolina. The following year, DPS began its School Meals for All initiative, which provides free daily breakfast and lunch to all students regardless of family income or school assignment. But the next step, creating a more nutritious menu for cafeteria staff to offer, would take more creativity with a limited budget. After schools reopened following COVID pandemic, DPS reconnected with Farmer Food Share and expanded its partnership as part of the district's effort to reshape student nutrition. Crane said, what DPS has been doing is radically re-envisioning their menu. And they're creating this market with their general budget, not federal funds. This is a systems-level change, not a one-off project. So during the 23-24 school year, DPS spent roughly $150,000 with Farmer Food Share. The next year, they more than doubled its commitment to about $500,000. Selling the public on buying fresh produce was the easiest part, says Thayer. Changing the minds of parents and students who are less inclined to give up certain foods or adopt new menu offerings would prove to be more challenging because the cultural relevance of certain foods. Thayer says it's very hard to argue because people are just visceral about what their kids eat and don't eat. And in theory, my doctor might have told me to eat less meat and more plants, but actionizing that at the school level, we got all sorts of things. Thayer established a school food policy council to give high school and middle school students a voice during the process of making these menus and built relationships in the community to get a better understanding of the ways that food culture is important to Durham families. The program now serves delicious, locally sourced produce to Durham's 30,000-plus student population, but it's not without its challenges. Many schools in the district have kitchen equipment built primarily to house prepackaged, processed meals, not fresh foods that lack preservatives. Even if there is an appetite for kitchen remodeling in DPS schools, industrial-sized kitchen equipment is not cheap. For Durham's culinary business community, equipment is the most significant hurdle to growth. DPS will have to crunch the numbers on how to finance those needs in the school district's forthcoming 10-year capital improvement plan, says Rogers. Quote, even when you're building a home, a kitchen is one of the biggest investments, but in schools, that's pretty much the last thing on the list. Education funding at the federal level seems to be on the chopping block as the Trump administration looks to eliminate the Department of Education altogether. But healthy food advocates have strange bedfellow in Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, who has taken aim at overprocessed foods as part of his Make America Healthy Again campaign. Kennedy has created fertile ground for a nationwide discussion about healthier student meals. But Crane says scientists and health advocates were ahead of the curve before RFK Jr. reintroduced the idea into the public discourse. Crane says, I think the rising public awareness around the importance of nutrition has put public pressure on a lot of school feeding programs around the country, and there's been a lot of growing pains with that. But still, I think there's been a lot of joy in people seeing their kids get to eat fresher and more like culturally relevant foods in their school system. Well, some factor of karmic injustice has compelled this next article to follow the Nutritious Meals one. And it's titled Sweet Treats on Wheels, originally from the 9th Street Journal. And it goes like this. Charlie Armitage, 23, pulled her car up on Wanamaker Drive at Duke University on a breezy Tuesday night. A pink, pale, green, and blue rosary banged against her dashboard with each turn. 6:25, so we're perfect. Right on time, she said, glancing at her watch. Oh, my gosh, I think this is her. She turned on her hazards, hopped out of the car, grinning from ear to ear. Hey, would you happen to be Alex? She called out to the young woman waiting on a bench outside of Kewahani Dorm. Armitage is one of two owners, managers, delivery drivers, bakers, and everything in betweeners from Ollie's Great Bakery. Her black Nissan Kick is her home for 6 hours every day. She drives from Duke to UNC Chapel Hill to North Carolina State, delivering fresh baked brownies, cupcakes, cookie cakes, and Ollie's Delight. That's brownies with marshmallows, chocolate peanut butter crunch, and a peanut butter drizzle to students who are the bulk of her customer base. With the back seat of the car down, there was plenty of room for the evening's deliveries. Armitage grabbed a box of blue and white frosted cupcakes from the trunk. Happy anniversary toppers were carefully placed on each cupcake. The box sat beside a butterfly-patterned happy anniversary balloon with a silver tinsel balloon weight. Alex walked back toward her dorm, smiling, six cupcakes richer with the balloon floating in the sky behind her. Armitage launched Ollie's Great Bakery in 2021 with her high school sweetheart and now fiancé, Cameron Kellogg, 25. They were both students at UNC at the time. Armitage had transferred from Durham Tech Community College, and Kellogg's was a Morehead Cain scholar. Ollie is named after Kellogg's late great-grandmother who taught him how to bake as a kid. She passed away from COVID when she was 97. Armitage said, we were on a walk, and we were like, we want to do something that gives back in a way, as Italians, as people who love food, and in honor of her, we were like, we're going to start baking for family and friends and see how it goes. Now Ollie's employs both of them full-time. It's 24/7. Ollie's advertises it brings a taste of home to students, friends, and family. Every bakery item homemade in the Paris kitchen in Mebane, North Carolina. They live surrounded by farmland with only one neighboring home. Armitage said there's not much in Mebane. The secret to Ollie's mouth-watering brownies that is only possible in rural Mebane? Chickens. We have 20-something, maybe 30 chickens. Armitage and Kellogg consider themselves chicken-raising experts now. It's a whole science, she said. Eventually we got a whole incubator. I have videos of them hatching. We went through two different periods of raising them from eggs, watching them. You have to flip them every couple of hours for months. Yet Armitage insists this work is worth it. Have you ever had an egg from a chicken farm fresh? They're so much better. They're this rich orange color. They're not neon yellow, and they taste so much richer. Armitage said her secret charm is to make sure she's in a good mood before she goes to work. Yet while she is dedicated to uplifting others, she hasn't always had a strong support system. Her parents struggled with substance abuse, and she moved out of her childhood home in Wilmington as soon as she turned 18, graduating from high school in December of her senior year. She said, "I stayed with friends. I was in social service for a while, then I moved in with Cam in Chapel Hill." Armitage said she'd been embraced by the Kellogg family, which she has known since her freshman high school year. As she arrived at the final delivery of the night, she explained she loves people and wants her customers to have an enjoyable experience. She said, "Sometimes it puts me in a better mood and gets me through the hard times by being positive for other people. You feed off other people's energy, so if you can bring that positive energy, it can make you feel happier too." Well, what the heck? Let's just do more food. Here's another article at New Chapel Hill Cafe, a riff on a family legacy with green beans and cornbread flights. When Chapel Hill icon Mildred Mama Dip Council's restaurant closed its brick and mortar last August after 48 years, it left a hole in the community that went beyond good Southern cooking. The restaurant was a social anchor, a place where regulars and newcomers alike felt at home amongst wooden tables and comfort food. But the legacy continues in a new form next week when Council's granddaughter, Tonya, launches her own establishment with a fresh vision for bringing people together around a table. Tonya's cafe opened on Elliott Road on yesterday, March 19th, while Mama Dip's was housed in a homey building with porch rockers on walkable Rosemary Street. Tonya's presents a more contemporary space, bright blue walls, and a gallery wall of empty picture frames in a shopping center that includes a children's clothing boutique, florist, and a UPS store. Tonya Council says, "I'm trying to keep the tradition going in my own kind of way." She adds her grandmother was a pillar in the community. Mildred Council died in 2018 at age 89. "I'm not trying to fill those shoes. I'm just trying to keep the memory alive and get good food going." That good food, displayed at a recent preview event, buffet style, hits a sweet spot between nostalgic Southern comfort and contemporary cafe fare. Bill Smith, former chef of Crook's Corner, the now-closed Chapel Hill landmark that, like Mama Dip's, helped define the town's food industry, had this to say. There's a little bit of old, a little bit of new. And he adds, "I love these green beans that are cooked to death. Nobody does that anymore." At Crook's, Smith made the beans crispy and bright green. "But there's something to be said for the old ways," he says. "I remember my grandmother coming in one time and she turned to me. She said, 'I don't care what you say, these beans are raw.' So I was delighted to see that big bowl of those old-fashioned green beans at Tonya's." Among other dishes that honor Southern cooking techniques at Tonya's is the chicken and pastry, flat squares of dough swimming in a thick savory sauce alongside tender shredded chicken. It's deliciously salty and carries forward a favorite from Mama Dip's. Tonya Council says, "That's something I grew up watching my grandmother make all the time." While classics make an appearance, Tonya Council has developed her own menu identity. Sandwiches, which were not offered at Mama's, featured prominently on the Tonya's Cafe menu. Catfish po' boys, chicken salad croissants, a burger topped with pimento cheese and onion jam, and a Monte Carlo with blueberry jam made in Little Switzerland, North Carolina. Along with the menu's more playful innovations is a cornbread flight featuring three varieties, traditional, sweet potato with cinnamon, and jalapeno cheddar. Tonya Council plans to offer a pie flight as well, with 3 or 4 mini slices served alongside ice cream. The cafe occupies the space adjoining Tonya's Cookies and Bake Shop, which got celebrity nods in 21 and 24 when the shop's pecan crisp cookies and cream cheese pound cake were named to Oprah's favorite things list. The 1,200 square foot cafe space was always part of Tonya Council's plan, though she had to wait for UPS to complete their build out, as they were temporarily using it as a staging area, she says. In addition to the bakery and cafe, Tonya Council operates Sweet Tea and Cornbread at Crabtree Valley Mall and NC Made, an online shop featuring North Carolina products. Tonya's Cafe will serve lunch during the week and brunch on weekends. Remember, they're open already now, with plans to ease into dinner service in the future. The space features 5 outdoor tables for al fresco dining options. All right, next, a regular feature in Indie Week, what to do in the Triangle this week, and it's an extremely short list of recommended events, concerts, things of various natures that the couple of editors of Indie Week include now, and usually 1 or 2 things a day. First to attend, going on right now, the Raleigh Comedy Festival in downtown Raleigh. Just like its namesake city, the inaugural comedy festival promised to be an expansive but walkable affair. 3 nights. The first night is Thursday, the 20th, and 6 downtown venues, 17 shows, and more than 50 comedians. Headliners include former SNL cast member Luke Null, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, alum Caitlin Pelufo, and musical comedy duo Good Cop, Rad Cop. Festival goers can stroll between downtown bars to catch back-to-back sets, stand-up showcases, and open mics. Tickets to individual shows start at $20, but you can also snag an all-access festival pass for $150. Look up at the Raleigh Comedy Festival online. For insiders and skeptics alike, don't miss the Roast of Raleigh at King's on Thursday night. Well, I'm not going to read that because it's already gone by before you'll hear this. To attend, Friday night at the Carey Night Market. Birds are chirping, flowers are blooming, and the sun is setting an hour later. If that's not enough motivation to get out and touch some grass this weekend, the Carey Night Market returns to downtown Carey Park this Friday after a wintertime hiatus. Pack your picnic basket and a sweater, maybe. Spend an hour or two eating, shopping, and people watching as the sun sets. The market features about 50 artisans selling everything from pottery to baked goods, a handful of food trucks, live music, and lawn games. The vendors are carefully curated and ever-changing. In honor of Women's History Month, all the businesses at this Friday market will be founded or run by women. While you're there, wander through the 7-acre park, which has a little something for everyone, 2 dog parks, a huge play structure, public art, and an open-air bar. Now we come to, again, another Friday event. Mentally, I'm Here. That's at the Motorco Music Hall over in Durham. Jews, the Lord, and Friends present Mentally, I'm Here. It's been 5 years since Raheem Williams, who performs as Jews, Lord Magnus, has released an album. The last release, the raw, relentless 19-song high-energy mosh pit Messiah, occasioned a rave profile in Indy. The Durham rapper's, quote, rage and anger are directly inspired by his commitment to speaking about the social injustices black communities face in America, wrote Kaisha Jennings. Now, Juice Lord is back with a 7-song release, Mentally I'm Here, and is releasing the project with a concert joined by guests and a first listen at Motorco. The concert poster features perhaps the most relatable image you'll see all year. a tiny, helpless-looking doodle figure against a blank space with the caption, "It's all I can do to keep sane." Keep sane at this Pay What You Can concert, and maybe consider paying a little more at the door. This special concert is raising money for Jews Lord's son, Onyx, who is battling brain cancer. Two more events. One is called To See. It's the Cosmic Rays Film Festival, March 21 to 23, at various times, playing at the Chelsea Theater in Chapel Hill. This is the brainchild of filmmakers Sabine Gruffat and Bill Brown. It's the 7th annual celebration of experimental short films, and it takes place at Chelsea this weekend, 2 evenings and 1 afternoon. Programs have poetic groupings and unfold in short dream-like bursts, also like poems. On Friday, the event kicks off at 7 p.m. with The Instability of Clouds, with 9 short films that range from 3.5 to 15 minutes. A 9 p.m. Showing Fellows with 7 films, excuse me, a 9 p.m. showing Follows with 7 films coagulated around night music. The open call is exciting, Brown told The Indian 2023, speaking about the lineup. We never know who will share work with us or what they'll send. Individual tickets for this, the Cosmic Rays Film Festival, $10 per program, $25 for a weekend pass. And finally then, wait, is it finally then, or is there more? Nope, that's it. The last one is March, that can't be right, the March 13th, it must be the 23rd. You know what, I'm not even going to read that because it may be over. All right, that's all for what their recommendations of curated, very, very short list of some things to do and see and hear. Here's the next long piece about it with the gentleman, an interview with Rob Christensen, and it's all about the Raleigh News and Observer and its legacy. One North Carolina governor called it congenitally critical. Senator Jesse Helms, not surprisingly, was a bit more pointed. The newspaper was vicious, a hit squad, cowardly, and slanderous to the point of libel. Other more sympathetic readers called it the most fearless paper in the South. It seems that for however long the Raleigh News and Observer has been printing the news, people have had opinions about it. Now, Rob Christensen, a journalist at the NNO for 45 years, has written a new book about his alma mater paper, Southern News, Southern Politics, How a Newspaper Defined a State for a Century. Out this month with the UNC Press, the book takes a close look at both the newspaper and the Daniels family, the powerful publishing dynasty that shaped North Carolina politics during their lengthy reign as publishers of this paper. Ahead of the book's release, the Indy spoke with Christensen about the NNO, the family behind it, and the future of media in the Tar Heel State. This is a Q&A sort of interview presented in print. Indy. Josephus Daniels, who published NNO for years, starting in the late 19th century, is a complicated man to understand in today's time, how he ran the paper, his politics, his legacy. How would you describe him first? A journalist, a publisher, an advocate? And Christensen says, you could describe him as a politician who ran a newspaper, or a newspaper man who was also a politician. He was both. That was not unusual in that age. He is a hard person to understand today. Nearly impossible. I think one person called him part of a group of Jim Crow liberals. That's sort of a mind-boggling concept, because people think of someone who is liberal as tied into racial fairness, but Josephus Daniels was a racist, certainly, and a white supremacist, and that didn't make him stand out in his day, but he was also progressive in many ways. He was a big supporter of women's suffrage, organized labor, and public education. He fought anti-Semitism. He fought the Klan. On so many issues, he was regarded as a liberal by people who were his contemporaries. It's hard to see that today because the racism clouds over all his other progressive ideas and efforts. This is a good segue to what was going to be my next question. I was wondering if you could put in context how different his more progressive stances at the paper were from most Southern publishers when he took over in the late 19th century, and the effect they had in the wider political context. This is, was the age of the huge corporations and U.S. steel and various monopolies. That was the age when railroads were as powerful as any of the social media are today, when you think about Facebook or X. Daniels was very close to William Jennings Bryan and helped him turn the Democratic Party in the 80s and 1890s from a party that was pretty conservative to a party that was worried about social and economic justice and fought some of those big corporations. Josephus Daniels was a very influential figure because he was very much a part of that movement of the American political left. Whether it was the populism of William Jennings Bryan, the progressiveness of Woodrow Wilson, or that New Deal liberalism with Franklin Roosevelt. But he was born during the Civil War. He was brought up during Reconstruction and in the part of the state that was most like the Old South and had the largest African-American population. So he was very much influenced by both the racism in that era and the glorification of the Confederacy, and also this real skepticism about big business. Question. His son, Jonathan, led the NNO to take a more moderate line on the race issue, but certainly not one that satisfied many in the civil rights movement. How did the NNO navigate issues around race? Jonathan took over the paper when his father became Franklin Delano Roosevelt's ambassador to Mexico in the 1930s. Jonathan had a totally different background than his father. Jonathan was born in the 20th century, just right at the very beginning. He was raised in Raleigh, but also in Washington, D.C., where his father was Secretary of the Navy under Wilson for 8 years, and so he was much better educated than his father. And he had some different approaches from his father. He was pushing for more racial fairness. Over and over again, he would print editorials attacking some of the most egregious examples of racism, police brutality, etc. But he really didn't feel like he could come out against segregation. In that era, there was no institution in the South of any size that was opposed to segregation. It was the whole ideology that was locked into the whole region. You know, Jesse Helms said in 1953 the paper had been selling out the South. That's how it was viewed by conservatives. But when we look at it today, it's like two steps forward, one step back. He and the paper were very, very incremental. And a lot of what he did really doesn't stand up today as being very progressive. But it was for the South of Jonathan Daniels' time. Over the entire 100-year-plus span of the Daniels family, what kind of impact did the paper have on North Carolina politics? Where did it succeed and where did it fail? Former Governor Jim Hunt said the NNO was the second most influential institution in the state in terms of its politics, the first being University of North Carolina. So here was the Observer, and it was mainly circulated in eastern North Carolina. That's the most conservative part of the state, and it was a progressive voice. It gave a lot of politicians political cover to push for more moderate policies like Terry Sanford, Jim Hunt, Frank Porter Graham, and other people. It had a major influence in terms of pushing the state and making it one of the more moderate states in the South. It was a very feisty, crusading newspaper. A lot of things that it pushed did not get passed, but it did mean, unlike a lot of other Southern states, there was a strong progressive voice. It was a must-read for all the people involved in the political and government world of North Carolina. In the last quarter of the book, you look at how the NNO struggles with many of the issues facing the newspaper industry as a whole. Over the past few years, it has lost subscribers, page numbers, and influence. What kind of impact do you think it has now in North Carolina? What do we lose as a reading public without a strong, vibrant newspaper? The NNO, like most newspapers across the country, is greatly diminished. It went, in a few years, from around 270 journalists to around 50. It is no longer as powerful or as feared, and it no longer has nearly as strong a voice in the capital as it once did. I think the fact we've had the rise of Republican control in the state, well, there are a lot of reasons, but one reason is the diminishment of the News and Observer and other newspapers as a counterbalance. Politicians feared the News and Observer. They're always looking over your shoulder, not only just at the state legislature, but at city councils and county commissioner meetings, school board meetings, but also college athletics and labor unions. There was a real watchdog element to the News and Observer, and that's diminished. That's not to say they don't still do good stories. It's just not the same. They still have some very good reporters, but they don't have the numbers anymore, so it's much more difficult for the paper to carry out its watchdog function. That hurts. Raleigh City Council again considers a separation allowance for five firefighters. At a budget work session, Raleigh's fire chief, Herbert Griffin, told council members since he started the job 4 years ago, five firefighters under his command have died. He was speaking to the realities of a profession that is unusually difficult and often dangerous. He told the council, firefighters have a 22% increased chance of catching cancer and dying at an early age. The expected lifespan for a firefighter 10 years ago is 59 years. That's facts. I wrote a white paper on it. As budget season gets underway, once again, the council once again is considering whether to approve a separation allowance for the city's firefighters, a type of temporary retirement benefit that Raleigh firefighters have been advocating for years. On Monday, the council heard from a consultant on the results of a citywide salary study, which included an evaluation of the cost to extend the separation allowance to firefighters, emergency communication staff, and some others. Under this separation allowance, firefighters would be eligible to retire after 30 years of service, while the city continues to pay them a percentage of their final salary. If they're still working at age 60 with 25 years of service, they could also receive that separation allowance. The benefit is paid out until age 62, when the employee is eligible to start collecting Social Security benefits. State law requires municipalities to pay law enforcement officers a separation allowance, and Raleigh police officers have had the benefit in place since way back in 1987. Herbert told the council this allowance would absolutely incentivize Raleigh firefighters to stay with the city, which has had trouble recruiting and retaining firefighters. He said it's a measure, an incentive as far as recruiting and retention. Currently, Raleigh's fire department of 632 total employees has 45 vacancies, according to a city spokesperson, with 47 recruits currently in the fire academy. On its website, the Raleigh Professional Firefighters Association says two firefighters quit the city's force each month on average, and it expects 60 vacancies in the department by fall. The academy has an attrition rate of about 12%, Herbert told the council, due to outside factors and the inability of some recruits to pass the EMT exam. Generally, the city of Raleigh's base pay ranges are below the market average across the board, according to the consultants who performed the compensation study. City workers make about 86% of the market average at the minimum pay range and about 93% at the maximum pay range. Finally, the council could consider pay increases from between 1% at a cost of $3.7 million in the next fiscal year to 15% at a cost of $56 million. City staff will bring its recommendations on increases to the council as part of the budget proposal coming up this spring. My last article I'll have time to read probably. Despite rumors swirling online, there weren't layoffs at Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools this week. Chaos reigned in the city school's parent Facebook groups this week as concerned masses took to the internet to share rumors of teacher layoffs, which spread through a convoluted game of telephone across the district. Several parents were upset they heard about the layoffs from their children, who they say heard it from teachers, rather than from the district, racking up hundreds of comments on some posts. Teachers fired, the Latin program eviscerated at Culbreth Middle, French no longer offered at McDougal Middle. The rumors were specific, grim, and, while not accurate, somewhat rooted in some reality. On Thursday afternoon, Superintendent Nia Hamlet sent out an email to staff and families to do some damage control and to clarify that no teachers had been laid off yet. She wrote in bold, CHHS has not eliminated specific world language or arts programming. Parents, she said, were hearing from their kids about the allotment process, quote, a routine look at every school's enrollment and current projected course registration numbers to ensure that in the next school year, teaching positions are distributed proportionately amongst our 20 schools. That's not quite the same as the mass layoffs or overall program cuts that Facebookers worried about, but it does mean that 31 school system staffers are in a very scary vocational purgatory through spring. No one usually hears about the allotment process because it's normally pretty uninteresting, said district spokesperson Andy Jenks. He says the district is aiming for an average class size of about 21 students for one teacher, which is a higher number of students than in past years. He says 4 or 5 years ago, even as enrollment numbers were dropping, some of the allotments were held harmless or stayed the same. But as the years have gone on and we've communicated our financial situation to our staff and our community, this is an example of where difficult decisions are being made to ensure the long-term financial health of our district. As in most North Carolina school districts, enrollment is down in CHCCS. The district has lost about 1,000 students, or 7%, in the past 5 years, meaning some classes may struggle to hit a new target enrollment. It's also forcing some tough decisions. If, hypothetically, only 5 students sign up for a French class, should the school have a full-time French teacher? What if only 1 student signs up? Hamlet said the district is looking at creative solutions, like having a teacher travel to multiple schools in a day, or having students travel to other schools for some electives. When those 31 staff members heard from their principals last week their positions might not exist next year, some of them, reasonably, told their students, who then told their parents. Hamlet said that each staffer is in a unique circumstance. Quote, this could include, but is not necessarily limited to, their position is transferring to another school. Their position is not yet available for 25-6 because of enrollment or registration numbers, but this could change, or another situation that is unique to their position or their school. Superintendent also said, we can't make guarantees at this time about finding other positions for the affected staff or whether students would have the option to take certain elective courses next school year. While this week's rumors may have gotten ahead of themselves, CHCCS parents are on edge for some good reasons. A reduction in force, that's a RIF plan, was put into effect last year, though that plan was focused on cuts to the central office before impacting anyone in a student-facing role. They're also likely reading national news, which from which the word layoffs may immediately trigger an image of a Linda McMahon-led Department of Education primly laying down a faulty magician's box to be gutted by the frenetic chainsaw of a perky Elon Musk. Last week, when we asked Jenks about federal funding to try to figure out what may be at risk, he highlighted about $12 million in the 2024 fiscal year. That includes $5 million from the Department of Education for Title I, special education and other programs, as well as nearly $3 million from the Department of Agriculture for school nutrition programs. Of the total, said Jenks, about $9 million, or 4% of the district's overall expenditures, is recurring, while the remainder consists of one-time pandemic relief funding that is no longer available. If there were reductions or eliminations in federal funding, we would have to look at reallocating local dollars to make sure all students continue to receive the support they need. If that does happen, administrators seem to have learned this week that it's best to keep their communication frequent and upfront with the highly educated and eagle-eyed parents of the school system. Hamlet wrote, "While the yearly allotment process has not typically been the topic of district-wide communication, we acknowledge that clear information directly from us would have been beneficial." Well, folks, our music brings us to a close for this week's edition of the Indie Week. It is available, always available, in its own website, indieweek.com. And this broadcast, narrowcast, whatever you call it, featuring me, John Federson, is available as of after our first broadcast, which is on Friday the 21st. So, until next week's issue, I will bid you adieu. Thanks for listening to the ncreadingservice.org. And you can hear us next week with lots of variety of info and fun, including things like chocolate. And so long for this week.